It's been a quiet week in Pittsburgh, my adopted hometown. The weather has veered between hot and cold like a student driver nervously changing lanes on the highway. One day the heat is on, the next day we need air conditioning, and then we need the heater back on again. But at least the weather gives us something to talk about so we don't have to discuss local politics, the feud between Rich Fitzgerald and Chelsea Wagner, or explain how a deceased congresswoman just won the primary election. For Russ Carlson, it's been a mixed-up kind of week. Russ hasn't gotten a lot of sleep lately because there are two pregnant women in his house. The first one is his wife, Amanda, who is in her eighth month and counting down the days until their first child will be born. She's had a difficult pregnancy, including strong cravings for beer, which she knows she cannot drink. So she insists that Russ drink the beers for her. Some days the cravings are so bad he has to drink three bottles, with Amanda watching every sip he takes with an envious, angry gaze. And then there is Daphne the cat, who turned out not to have been spayed, and who gave birth to a litter of four kittens 2 days ago in a basket of clean laundry in the side room. One kitten didn't make it, which happens, but the surprise of its death and Amanda's emotional condition made it all a bit traumatic for everyone in the household. Russ had felt ill-prepared to be a midwife for the cat. He felt really unprepared to be father to whatever Amanda was hiding behind her maternity clothes. He would wake up early in the morning, his mind racing, unable to get back to sleep, and so he'd go downstairs to read and to think about life for a while. Russ was one of those guys that always read the big articles in the Post-Gazette, the latest news about Nepal or North Korea or the Islamic State. But lately he'd been drawn to the odd little stories that would pop up on the side of his iPad. Stories about the California man who tore a tendon in his hand because he'd played Candy Crush almost nonstop for 6 weeks straight. Or the true story that came from North Bosnia, in which a local man claimed that his home over the past several years had been hit by no fewer than 6 meteorites. The story was reported in the British Daily Telegraph, and as statistically improbable as it sounded, the meteorites were actually confirmed by Belgrade University, who were now studying to see whether strange magnetic fields existed over this man's house. The man, though, had his own explanation for the occurrence. He simply said, "Well, I'm obviously being targeted by extraterrestrials." Obviously. Russ didn't know what to make about all this as he made his way to church that morning. Amanda was sleeping in. The cat and kittens were playing while he found something red to wear since it happened to be Pentecost. Russ chatted with folks as he made his way into the sanctuary, and they would ask him about Amanda. They would share with him their own mixed story of news from their lives, happy stories about babies and graduations, sad stories about funerals and cancer diagnoses. And like those little sidebars, they'd share unusual stories, maybe not about meteorites hitting Pittsburgh, but how one person still has a baby tooth in her mouth, or how someone just got a singing telegram. Honestly, do people really still send singing telegrams? So Russ was thinking what a crazy world it is when the service began, and he hears once more the familiar readings about Pentecost from Acts chapter 2. There are all those details about a rushing wind and about tongues of fire and how people in the crowd think that everyone's drunk even though it's only 9 in the morning. But Russ's favorite part of that passage is when the preacher has to read off that long list of names. Parthians, Elamites, residents of Cappadocia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Libya, and all the rest. The names are like pages out of some obscure stamp collector's album. And where are all these places? Heck, thought Russell, It's just as confusing today. There's tons of places I don't know where they are. North Bosnia, South Sudan, Azerbaijan, Namibia, Palmyra. Between his soon-to-be-born baby, the kittens, the beer, the meteorites, and now all this Pentecost names, Russ left church that day feeling more than a little unsettled. And so on his way home, he decided to stop in Highland Park and see an old friend of his. The friend's kind of an unusual gentleman. He's a piano-playing Presbyterian entomologist named Virgil Carlson. Virgil was always a bit of a joker. When people would ask him about his family, he would say, "Oh, my family was pretty tough. My mother, she buried three husbands, and two of them were only napping." When people would ask him about his name, he would say, "Well, I'm named after the American composer Virgil Thompson, or I'm named after the Roman poet Virgil." But since most people had never heard of either of them, his explanations helped very little. But on that day, Russell pulled up to his house, and Virgil was out on the front porch smoking a cigar. The odd thing is, Virgil doesn't smoke. So Russell walked up the front steps, shaking his head, and said, "Virgil, what are you doing with a cigar?" Puffing out a big ball of smoke, Virgil said in his Tennessee drawl, "Well, son, I've come to believe that when we get old, we need to acquire new vices. Otherwise, God won't be interested in us. When you get to be as old as I am, sometimes you have to wave your arms at God to get his attention. So I figured cigar smoking was as good a vice as any." So Russ took a seat on the porch, and Virgil could tell something was on the young man's mind, but he knew that Russ would eventually open up and tell him, so he just waited and puffed away on his Cuban cigar. And after a spell, Russ said to him, "You know, Virgil, life can be complicated. Between work and home, I just don't feel like I'm keeping up with things. There's Amanda, and there's the baby, and there's all the things I read in the newspaper and hear about through the internet. My life just feels more and more like it's spinning out of control." Virgil put down his stogie and let out a sigh. He said, "Russ, there's no denying that the world is complex. Millions of things are happening right this very moment, and that's just counting the biological stuff happening in your own body while you sit here on my porch. You've got cells dying and regenerating, nerves firing, muscles twitching, tiny arm hairs reacting to the breeze, and skin cells soaking up the sunlight, rods and cones in your eyes adjusting to the light and shadows. Son, if you think the world's complex, you're complex. You're a living, walking miracle. But I swear it'll make your head spin if you think about it too closely." I watched an old movie the other day. It was a movie called Shine. It was about this Australian pianist named David Helfgott. And the movie focused on Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto, one of the hardest pieces of music ever written. The concerto begins actually with a simple, almost childish melody. Bum ba da dum ba da dum bum ba da da dum bum bum ba da dum ba da dum. Five notes. Five notes are all that's used in the melody. For the first two pages, the pianist plays that melody in unison with both hands. A 10-year-old could learn the whole melody in about a half hour. But then the notes double, from eighth notes to 16th notes. It becomes a continuous stream that flows for a few more pages, and then things really pick up. The soloist moves from playing about 8 notes a measure to 17 notes a measure to over 28 notes every single measure. By the time the first 2 minutes of that concerto are over, the pianist has played over 1,500 notes. And this devilish piece is 45 minutes long. That works out to over 30,000 notes stacked in rumbling chords and flying by in demonic runs. So what are the odds that any person could memorize that many notes, or more importantly, play them in the right order? Statistically, it's like a meteorite hitting you. It's almost impossible, and yet it happens all the time. Pianists master and perform the Rock 3 every year. There's one point in that movie where the professor is listening to Helfgott play the first movement, and the professor admonishes him to make sure he's hitting all the right notes, but then he says something profound. He says, "You've got to first learn the notes and then forget them if you're going to want to play this piece." Now, I can't play this concerto, but I know what he's talking about. Our hands can be trained to play the right notes, even 30,000 of them, but not if you try and tell your fingers which note to play in what order separately. You have to let go. You have to learn the notes and then forget them and just make music. You have to trust. Now, Russ wasn't a pianist. He thought about those notes on the page, and he thought about his own life for a moment. He became acutely aware of his own body and its complexity as he sat there on Virgil's porch, how his dress shoes pinched a little, and how he shouldn't have had that second cup of coffee at the fellowship hour. He pictured Amanda back at home, sitting at the kitchen table, reading the paper, stretching out her stiff back or brushing crumbs off her pregnant belly. He thought about the kittens inside, the birds outside. He thought about the hundreds of houses in Pittsburgh, the thousands of houses in Pennsylvania, the millions of those details of life being played out across the world. So how is he supposed to wrap his mind around all these things? And here he was about to bring a child into this crazy, complicated, out-of-control world. It made him shake his head and wonder. And at that point, Virgil got up. And Virgil looked to the steeple of East Liberty Presbyterian Church that he could see just visible behind the elm trees. He said, "You know, I'm glad you went to church this morning. Pentecost, isn't it? Some people like a personal Jesus. Jesus, our friend. Jesus, our therapist. Jesus as someone who walks with me and talks with me, and he tells me I am his own. But for me, I prefer the crowd scenes. Jesus feeding 5,000 people from a few loaves and fishes. Jesus doing his Sermon on the Mount, telling them to consider at once all the lilies of the field, all the birds of the air. For as the good book says, are not two sparrows sold for a penny, and yet not one of them falls to the ground apart from the Father. But do not be afraid, for you are worth much more than many sparrows." See, Russ, I like the Bible's crowd scenes because I spend my life dealing with bugs and insects. And frankly, in relation to them, we're hopelessly outnumbered. There are 5,000 species of mammals. There are 10,000 species of birds, but there are almost a million species of bugs in the world. Almost 80% of all life on Earth are insects. There's a good reason why the biologists have said that God is inordinately fond of beetles. Now, I've shown you those etymology collections at the Carnegie Museum. I helped organize some of those cases of the bugs, and every time I examine a new aphid or moth or dragonfly, I too am struck by how complex our world is. I've spent my life studying these insect species, but I've only scratched the surface of what they amount to. I practice the piano every day, but I'll never be able to play Rachmaninoff's concerto with all of its 30,000 notes. But that doesn't fill me with dread. It energizes me. It excites me. It makes me happy, son. It's like those crowd scenes in the Bible. Book of Revelation, 144,000 before a throne. A great multitude that no one can count, coming from every nation, from every tribe and every people and every language, and together saying, "Blessing and glory and wisdom and honor and power and might be to God forever." It's not for me to understand how this all holds together, where all those people come from, how they learn to communicate with each other and understand each other, and heck, how they keep from killing each other. It's not for me to master the details. I simply trust that God knows the details of life, including my details. My job is to find a way to add my voice to that heavenly chorus, to play my note in the great song of life. Because Christian faith doesn't start with understanding everything. Christian faith starts with trusting God. After a while, Russ drove home. He parked his car in the driveway. He noticed a fat beetle on the sidewalk and two butterflies by the azaleas and a bee buzzing near the corner of the porch awning. And he smiled and thought of Virgil. Through the screen door, he could see Amanda, heavy with child, dangling a shoelace in front of two kittens near her feet. And he thought about the multitude from every nation sitting on their porches, anxiously awaiting their own firstborn children, offering up their own prayers to God. You start with trust, not with knowledge. You learn the notes, and then you forget them. And you happily join in life's melody of praise. And that's the news from Pittsburgh, where all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, and all the Presbyterians are above average.